From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Corlett, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Today I'll speak with author and journalist Stephen Kinzer about how easing hostility between the United States and Iran might be the best way to advance the interests of the United States in the Middle East.
Iran has long-term strategic interests that coincide with ours, and if we want to promote our long-term strategic interests, well, that's something we ought to take seriously.
But first, Rebecca Cruz and I discuss this week's tragic 20th anniversary of the massacre of thousands of Muslim men and boys in Srebrenica, Bosnia.
These men that were killed, women that were raped, ethnic cleansing that occurred, how to come to terms with that. It's been very, very difficult, but it is going to take generations for this reconciliation to actually occur.
These conversations are coming up right after this hour's news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Corlett. Rebecca Cruz, we're recognizing this week that it's been 20 years since the massacre in Srebrenica, Bosnia. Let's remind ourselves what happened there. This area had been declared a safe zone, and yet 7,000 Bosnian Muslim men and boys were slaughtered. This was the worst single case of genocide on European soil since the Second World War. It was a deliberate slaughter of civilians. These were not military personnel, but men and boys that perhaps, I guess the thinking was, could perhaps engage in combat. But anyway, it took a couple of months for anyone to respond. There were eventually NATO bombings in Serbia that forced Slobodan Milosevic to negotiate a peace treaty in Dayton, Ohio, resulting in what we call the Dayton Accords. So as we mark this tragic anniversary, and we think about how Bosnia is still recovering today. You and I have both been there. We've seen the devastation. But what are we to make of progress, not only in Bosnia, but in general on this issue of ethnic cleansing and genocide? We see this stuff going on still today in other parts of the world. I mean, how are we to recognize this terrible event of 20 years ago in light of the fact that these things are still going on today in other places?
I think that it's important that you mention that this continues. I think in a lot of ways this seems very far and distant, but 20 years is not that long ago. The people, you and I, remember that time. There's certainly people that lived through it. There's a whole generation of children that came out of those wars as the victims of war rape, and those are issues that Bosnia and the entire former Yugoslav area continue to deal with. But if we think about genocide, and this is a term that we've talked about in several instances on this show, this is one of the few instances where genocide has actually been legally declared by the tribunals that you mentioned, the tribunal on the former Yugoslavia. The first person that was actually convicted of genocide relating to Srebrenica was in 2001. What I think is so interesting about this is the tribunal is a UN body, and yet this week the United Nations tried to make a declaration declaring this a genocide, and Russia refused to sign it. So there are still some disagreements over exactly what this was and how we legally think about that. And that's been a big issue if we think about the world in general for the last couple of decades. We've talked in here with our colleague Joshua Landis a great deal about Syria. There have been claims that the Syrian president, up until a couple of years ago when ISIS became a different issue, that he was engaging in ethnic cleansing. There were those that were pushing for us to label that as genocide. The United States government it never went that far. But just 2 or 3 weeks ago, we had a situation where the leader of Sudan, who is wanted by the International Criminal Court for genocidal acts and acts against humanity, he's been indicted and has been wanted for over 6 years, was able to leave his country, travel to South Africa, and even though there was an arrest warrant for him, he was not turned in and he was able to return to his country. So this issue continues. We continue to see these awful acts, and it really is it's important for us to recognize Srebrenica, to recognize that this happened, but to also recognize that it continues to happen and there continue to be issues with how we deal with this as a society, as a global society.
Well, clearly struggling with humanitarian crises and intervention in general. I mean, we now have the largest humanitarian crisis ever recorded in Syria, millions of refugees. You mentioned this, the tribunals, though, and I guess, for lack of a better way of putting it, the jury is still out on the success of these kinds of activities. But what we perhaps need to think about a little more deeply is the importance of reconciliation processes and truth-telling. And not just, I mean, you've got to have the justice process. I mean, clearly, that's very important. But in light of serving justice, and I don't know that we've even gotten there given these tribunals haven't necessarily done that for us, and we're still seeing these things happen today, but the very difficult process of just reconciling in a post-conflict zone of bringing those parties back together. And Bosnia is an excellent example of how difficult it is to bring those different parties back together and to reconcile their differences and to move forward.
Well, in particularly in Bosnia, we're talking about a relatively small area. We're talking about three ethnic or religious groups that were in very nasty conflict with one another. These men that were killed, women that were raped, ethnic cleansing that occurred. How to come to terms with that? It's been very, very difficult. The outside, particularly Europe, but the United States to some extent through our organizations have attempted to do this. But it is going to take generations for this reconciliation to actually occur.
Well, and hopefully we'll learn some lessons from the past.
We hope so.
Thank you so much, Rebecca, as always, for your insight.
Thank you.
You can learn more and share your thoughts about this conversation by visiting the Worldview section at kgou.org, where you can find all of our past episodes, interview transcripts, and web posts related to these topics. You can also follow us on Twitter, at WorldviewsKGOU, and at Suzek Rolat. Coming up, I'll speak with author and journalist Stephen Kinzer, whose 2010 book, Reset, argued that the United States needs to change its Middle East strategy and reassess its policy towards Iran. I'm Suzek Rolat, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzek Rolat. My guest today is journalist Stephen Kinzer, whose 2010 book critiques U.S. policies in the Middle East and argues a partnership with Iran would advance U.S. interests and help promote stability in the region. Stephen Kinzer, welcome to Worldviews.
Wonderful to be here.
In fact, welcome back to Worldviews. It's been a few years, so we were welcoming you back.
It's been too long.
Well, speaking of the last time you were here, I'd like to go back a little ways and touch on the book that you wrote, published in 2010, I believe, called Reset, Iran, Turkey, and America's Future. And you made the argument at that point in time that we should kind of hit the reset button, reset our foreign policy priorities in the United States, and that we should work more closely with Iran and Turkey, and made a wonderful argument about why we should do that. So here we are a few years later. I have to ask, have we reset our foreign policy? Are we heeding your advice? Are we moving down that path to work more closely with Iran, certainly?
It's an interesting situation that I've faced with this book, Reset, and I haven't had this experience with any of my other books. When this book first came out, proposing, as you say, that Iran and Turkey are actually our best long-term allies in that part of the world, I was met with a considerable amount of skepticism, in particular the aspect of Iran. Some people said to me, well, Turkey I can understand being a long-term partner of the United States, but Iran just seems too crazy, too far-fetched. Now, this book has had a new shelf life. I'm now getting new requests to come and talk about this book years after it's been published. That hasn't happened with any of the books I've written before. And I think it's because some of the critiques I made about American policy toward the Middle East have played out in real life. We found out that some of our so-called friends in the Middle East are actually financing people who are trying to kill us out there. So we've been financing some of our own assassins, meanwhile turning our back on potential partners. Now, what interesting thing has happened is that Turkey in the last months has seemed to be drawing away from its cooperation with the United States, whereas Iran is seeming more and more open to a new relationship with us. So it raises this question of whether over the years to come, maybe Iran will become the more democratic of those countries. Iran is on an interesting path. If the pressure from outside can be reduced, I wonder if Iran might begin to evolve towards a stable democratic form of government that would actually allow it to be a model in a region where stability is in very short supply.
Well, I think some of the critics might say, what is the evidence to suggest that Iran is actually moving down some sort of democratic path? Can you give us some sense, some examples? It had perhaps some democratic roots and some activities in the past, but currently, does it really look like it's moving towards some sort of democratic transition?
Iran has had a constitution for more than 100 years. Some countries in the Middle East don't even have a constitution today. Now, that constitution has not always been followed. There have always been elections in Iran, but those elections have not always been fair. They've always been restricted in one way or another. Nonetheless, Iranians have had 100 years of experience with the framework of democracy. They know what is a parliament, what is a political party, who do you vote for? You don't vote for somebody who lives in your neighborhood or is in your same sect or your same tribe. You vote for somebody whose views represent your views. These are actually fairly sophisticated ideas because democracy is not just an election. Democracy is a whole way of dealing with life's problems. And Iran has been moving in this direction irregularly with a lot of fits and starts for more than a century. Now, in the recent presidential election, an overwhelming victory was won by a candidate who was openly committed to more democracy, more transparency in government, and better relations with the outside world. Now, that candidate had to be chosen from among a very limited list. Iranians are not allowed to vote for anyone they want. Clerics decide who gets to be on the ballot. Nonetheless, within the choices that were offered, Iranians overwhelmingly voted for a candidate who promised more progress toward democracy and more openness towards the outside world. If there can be some progress, particularly between the United States and Iran, I think you're going to see some of the pressure on Iranian society lessening, and that will allow the leaders to feel that more open society is not necessarily a threat to them. Iran, if you look around the region now, is kind of an island of stability in a sea of upheaval. That's something we ought to take seriously. In addition, Iran has long-term strategic interests that coincide with ours. Iran is the militant enemy of radical Sunni terrorist groups like ISIS and al-Qaeda. We say that those groups are our enemies also. But we're thousands of miles away and come from a completely different culture. If we want to combat those groups effectively, we need partners on the ground that know the neighborhood. We should get over our emotions about Iran, many of which are based on real slights and serious damage that these two countries have done to each other, and not be imprisoned by our history forever. Emotion is always the enemy of wise statesmanship. And if we want to promote our long-term strategic interests, we ought to put aside emotions and look coolly at who are our real friends in that part of the world.
Well, as you talk about the emotional relationship here and the fact that, I mean, quite clearly we just don't trust each other, at least the United States does not trust Iran. I mean, you talked about in previous setting about how this is a different narrative than what you hear coming out of Washington and other areas of the country where there is just this extreme lack of trust. How is that taking hold? Is it taking hold? Do you have allies within the government that are actually now, you know, making these arguments? Because it's that's what it's going to take, right? Is that kind of leadership from the inside to pick up this narrative and say, okay, it's time to really work with Iran?
Hostility between the United States and Iran has been going on for so long, 35 years now, that it's not just a policy. It's an institution. It's a fundamental building block of international geopolitics. That's a very hard thing to break away from. These are countries that have done each other serious damage over many years. Iranians have good reason to be angry with the United States, and Americans have good reason to be angry with Iran. Now, in Washington, you definitely do get this narrative that Iran is the incarnation of evil in the world. It's far from reality, but I think it does tap into emotions that are in some ways still a hangover of the hostage crisis from decades ago. Nonetheless, I do think there is a realization in some quarters in Washington that this emotion is actually preventing us from advancing our own strategic interests. I'm impressed that President Obama has made the changes in personnel in his administration that have made it possible for us to reach out to Iran. Now, in order to begin a new relationship with Iran, we need some fundamental commitments and understandings on both sides. And any agreement has to be based on complete inspections. It has to be based on verifiable changes. It's not something that can be based on trust or a handshake. Our history makes that impossible. Nonetheless, that kind of a deal is achievable. I think the fact that we're now sitting down and exchanging points of view with Iran is something very positive. It used to be during the years when George W. Bush was in power that our policy was never to concede the idea that Iran could have legitimate security interests. In fact, that was a rule in the Bush administration. You couldn't use that phrase regarding Iran. If Iran had security interests, they could not be legitimate. They were always hegemonic and they were always dangerous to us. I think that's the way Iran looked at our strategic interests. However, if you look at the ability that Iran has to stabilize Iraq, which is a mostly Shiite country, and of course Iran is the heartland of Shiism, if you look at the ability that Iran has to stabilize Afghanistan, realizing that the whole western third of Afghanistan used to be part of Iran up until Iran lost a war a couple of hundred years ago, you realize that Iran has the capacity to advance stability in the Middle East in ways that we don't. So we should try to break away from the prison of history and start looking toward the future. If we do that, I think we'll see some intriguing possibilities for a new relationship with Iran.
That's Stephen Kinzer, a journalist and author who has spent his career writing about global politics and the history of U.S. foreign policy. We'll continue our conversation right after a short break. I'm Suzette Guerlat, and you're listening to Worldviews. Welcome back to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Guerlat, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Today I'm speaking with Stephen Kinzer, who spent more than 20 years as a foreign correspondent for the New York Times. In 2010, he published a book arguing that Iran is a logical partner for the United States to promote its interests in the Middle East. Before the break, he explained how a better relationship between the U.S. and Iran could help stabilize the region. Well, I want to turn just a little bit. I mean, you mentioned President Obama. You know, I referred a little bit ago to leaders and leadership. And one of the things that I think is evident in your work, you seem to have this theme about the importance of particular people and individuals in history and how they really play a role and make a significant difference in moving forward and perhaps, as you're suggesting, focusing on the future and making these decisions. What it's going to take is leadership and particular individuals that will move these things forward. Otherwise, they won't happen. Is this fair to characterize your work in this way or your arguments in this way?
Those of us who make a business of looking at the world and trying to analyze what's happening and how we got there tend, I think, often to underestimate one factor, which is the role of individuals. We like to think that the world is shaped by processes and themes and trends and ideologies, and all of that is true. But I do believe that the private psychology of individuals is also a determining factor in the shaping of world politics. And I think perhaps this comes from my own personal experience as a journalist. So I was a New York Times correspondent for many years, and I've got to watch some world leaders close up. I was essentially living with them on a day-by-day basis and watching them function. This goes all the way from Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua to Slobodan Milosevic in Serbia. Knowing their histories and their stories helped me understand the way they behaved. And I came to realize that if you understand their backgrounds and who they are and what they do, you can understand their countries better. You cannot understand, for example, the developments in Rwanda over the last 20 years without understanding the person who has shaped and dreamed this whole process. History is full of examples of people who seize control of their destinies. You know, I sometimes use the analogy of watching after a storm a stream of water running down a curb and you see a leaf on it and the leaf is just being carried along by the stream. Many people think history runs that way, that it's just a current. But actually, you can seize control of the direction of that current, and there are so many examples of this. So I do believe that the role of the individual in history is sometimes underplayed, and it's also a way for us to understand the processes of society better. Look at the way individuals react. This is a way that all of us can feel connected. One thing we all have in common is that we're all people. We're all individuals. We're all shaped by emotions, and we're all shaped by our pasts, by our prejudices, by our upbringings. When people come into power, they carry that with them. So, yeah, I do think that in my work I've tried to use the stories of individuals to tell the stories of history. And I do that for two reasons. First of all, because I think individuals are very important in history, sometimes more than we like to admit. But also, it makes for a better story. This is a way that you can drive a narrative. People are fascinated by other people. And I try to use that fact as a way to make my books more interesting.
So cultivating leaders then is obviously really key, and creating institutions where leaders can actually lead. But in the United States of America, this is perhaps under some question. I mean, what you're arguing in many of your works require that we have strong leaders. Do we have that in this country anymore? Do we have those people that are willing to take those big, bold, courageous steps?
Our founding fathers were worried about creating too strong a presidency, too strong a central government, because they'd come out of a monarchical tradition. Some presidents have managed to break out of that. In the 20th century, Franklin Roosevelt would be a great example. Nonetheless, it's true that our political system is making it more and more difficult for individuals to lead. I hope we'll be able to get past that and produce leaders who are able to break away from some of the fetters of politics and realize we can make history if we want to.
Well, we can always have hope. Thank you so much, Mr. Kintzer, for being here with us today. Very insightful discussion. Thank you.
Look forward to next time. Thanks.
You've been listening to my conversation with journalist and author Stephen Kintzer. Visit the Worldviews page on KGOU.org to find a video of a lecture he gave last year at the University of Oklahoma and a link to his 2010 Worldviews interview with our former host, Zach Massetti. While you're there, you can listen to all of our past episodes and subscribe to our weekly podcast. Worldviews is a production of KGOU in collaboration with the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Sam Dupre produced this episode and writes our digital content with oversight from Brian Hardzinski. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Borlott.